Thank you, Alan, and thank you all for your invitation, for your welcome, for your great hospitality. I'm sorry that I'm going to be speaking backwards, as it were, to some of you, but it's lovely to have so many of you here today. As I said to Alan when I came in, I'm looking out and thinking, it's Saturday, guys. You ought to all to be in Waitrose or Tesco's or somewhere. How come you're here? That's a real sign of hope and encouragement, because there are many places in the UK where adult Christian education and fresh learning doesn't seem to be happening much, and it's really good to see you all here today. Now, I was given a free hand with my topic, and a theologian given a free hand for a topic ought in principle to talk about God, and a Christian theologian ought to talk about Jesus and God. Now, that may sound easy, but like a lot of things, it gets more complicated as you get closer. People often say to me, Tom, I've got a very easy question. And then they come up with, why did God allow evil? Or what did Jesus mean by the kingdom of God? And I have to explain that easy questions often have rather complex answers. Indeed, after I wrote three books with the word simply in the title, Simply Christian and Simply Jesus and Simply Good News, my American publisher said to me, Tom, sooner or later I have to sit you down and explain to you the meaning of the word simple. My answer was, if I'm in St. Andrews and somebody says, what's the way to Glasgow, please keep it simple, I could say, keep going west and a bit south and you can't miss it, but it might be kind to say that there is a river in the way a mile wide at its narrowest point, and that if you try and avoid that, there's a range of mountains. Oh, that's far too complicated, I don't want to know that. No, actually you do need to know it, and often things need to get more complex in order that they can get you where you want to go. Now, in a sense, what I'm talking about today is, in a sense, what Paul was talking about in Athens, which is a sort of natural theology, starting with the wider world and talking about God. And, as Paul did at the end of that reading we heard, bringing Jesus in at that point. I'll come back to that. The challenge of what is called natural theology is, in a sense, the challenge of public truth, rather than being merely the private truth of those who already believe. And my particular proposal is that this public truth does need to have Jesus at the middle of it, and once we do that, it starts to look quite different. I was working this out in the Gifford Lectures, which I did in Aberdeen last year, and today's lecture is an attempt to summarize some of that and also to move the argument further, because I got a lot of feedback from those lectures which made me scratch my head and think, I need to do things a bit differently, so that's what I'm trying to do today and in other places. My late mother, before she died earlier this year, asked me what the Giffords were about, and when I said natural theology, that didn't mean much to her, so I put it like this. People used to think, some people, that you could look at the natural world and argue up to God from there. Other people thought that wasn't such a good idea, but since Jesus himself was, face it, part of the natural world, a human being among human beings, whatever else he was, shouldn't we include him too? And if we did, perhaps we might learn something about the nature of knowledge itself. Now, I thought, saying this to my mother, that's enough for a 94-year-old lady in a nursing home. And my mother thought for a minute and then she said, I'm glad I don't have to listen to those lectures. So the book, when it comes, will be dedicated to her memory. Now, putting Jesus in the mix of natural theology has been strangely unfashionable, because what tends to happen in theology is that Jesus actually gets left out till the last minute. You might think that's what Paul did in Athens. When the theologian or the philosopher, having constructed an identikit picture of God, finally says, now, what would it mean if Jesus was the incarnation or embodiment of this God? I decided to try it the other way round, to the consternation of some who think it's cheating to put Jesus in the picture from the start. Oh, you're bringing in Christian theology. No, we're doing history. We're talking about a real human being. It's cheating not to put Jesus in there. He was a human who lived at a particular place and time, and the world of history, of space and time and matter, is part of the natural world. Go figure. But the world of history has seemed, over the last 200 years or more, to be much harder to get at, much harder to use than the world of the natural sciences. How can we be sure this happened or that happened? When it comes to Jesus, can we be sure he really even existed, let alone that he rose from the dead? And if we can't be sure of that, what happens to Christian theology? So people have tried to get their theology some other way and then hope that Jesus will fit in the middle. I resist that. But there is a problem. What do we mean by history itself? In a sense, this is an aside. In a sense, it's absolutely vital to what I'm going to say. So the meanings of the word history. Some of the most important words in the English language are annoyingly ambiguous. You will know that the Greeks had at least four words for love, whereas we slide around on the slippery meaning of the one that we've got. Well, the word history has at least three quite different meanings, and they've got all sorts of variations as well. First, there is history as the past, events that have happened. That's what historians study. But second, there is history as in things written about the past, what historians produce. Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War is a book, not itself the event. But third, there is history as task, research and debating and writing it all up, what historians do. Now, we move around easily between different senses, perhaps too easily. When a racing driver crashes, the television commentator says, oh, he's history. That means he's just in the past now, he's irrelevant. But then when Churchill said, history will be kind to me because I'm going to write it, that's the second. That's something written about the past, including some kind of evaluation. And the evaluation sometimes takes over. Like when Hillary Clinton said in 2011 of the Arab Spring, it's important to be on the right side of history. That assumes that history, world events, are inexorably moving in a particular way, and we know where they're going, and we know we have to get on board. She was, of course, radically wrong. Because, as another recent writer says, history is full of surprises. Well, yes. After all, we know almost none of the past. Most of it slips away and nobody records it. We know absolutely nothing of the future. So how can we say history grandly, meaning everything that ever has happened or will happen, and hope to deduce anything sensible for it? So that shows how slippery the word has become. But then when we're doing theology, there are two particular focal points of history which are important. And the first is the historical study of Jesus himself, which I've devoted a certain number of the years of my life to. Many people, including the blessed and beloved C.S. Lewis, have been very suspicious of historical Jesus studies, since most such portraits seem to be designed to cut Jesus down to size, to say he wasn't the Son of God until the much later church decided to call him that, and so on. And if really Jesus wasn't much like what the four Gospels say, then Christianity is indeed based on a mistake. And that, of course, was the conclusion which many in the 18th and 19th centuries, as well as the 20th, wanted to reach, since they preferred either deism, God as an absentee landlord, or rank Epicureanism, with any gods that might exist, out of the picture altogether. You know, the absentee landlord just becomes an absentee. And both of those theologies sit well with a merely human Jesus, merely human. And that's what they produced, by means of a reductive historiography that first regarded the strange elements in the Gospels as, quote, miracles, unquote, in the sense of arbitrary divine interventions, and then declared that we now knew, since the work of David Hume, that miracles don't occur. Thank you very much. You thus get a so-called historical Jesus in the first sense of history, the what actually happened sense, trimmed down to suit modern preconceptions. And many seeing that have suggested that we can never get back to what actually happened at all, and all the best we can do is to get the second sense, the historical Jesus in the sense of what historians write sense. All we have is your reconstruction, my reconstruction, Albert Schweitzer's reconstruction, Dominic Crossan's reconstruction, whatever. And that's as much historical Jesus as you can get. You see the slippage between the different senses of historical. And that idea has become very popular. with those who've said that we can't start our theological quest with Jesus. We rather have to fit him in to a framework we get from somewhere else. So they say, so don't try and get Jesus as he really was. We'll never get that. We'll just get your reconstruction, and why should we think any more of that? Now, it's true, of course, whatever you read, you have to be aware of who's writing it and from what point of view. But that doesn't mean you don't get real information. If you have a report of a football match, let's say between two teams in where I grew up, Newcastle and Sunderland, not that there will be too many of those at the moment since they're two divisions apart, you expect there to be plenty of local bias depending on which paper you're reading. But you don't expect them to tell you the wrong score. You allow for the bias, but you want to find out what happened. Now, the low point of historical Jesus research was the so-called Jesus seminar organized by some American scholars in the 1990s. There are many strident publications denying that Jesus did or said this or that, have been used as an excuse by some theologians for saying that we have to abandon history sense three, the task of history, altogether. And this is where the verbal slippage really kicks in. Don't give us history in terms of research and reconstruction, they say. That is bound to cut Jesus down to size. Instead, we simply have to say that Jesus is the Lord of history. This is the second sense of history. History as history of Jesus, and now history as everything that ever happened or will. Not as what historians do or study or produce, but a massive, all-embracing, extended sense of every possible event in space and time. And such theologians will claim that God is sovereign over history in this sense, or that Jesus is somehow the Lord of history in this sense. But claims like this tell us precisely nothing about what actually happened, about who Jesus really was. And what he meant by what he did and said. It's a bit like asking your bank manager what you've got in your account and receiving the reply, money. You know, saying history in this huge generalized sense may be true at one level, but it really isn't helpful. And if we want, as theologians and preachers rightly want, to talk about God incarnate, we ought not to do so until we have looked very carefully, and that means historically, at the incarnate God. Otherwise, we merely put the cart before the horse. Nobody has seen God, declares John. The only begotten Son has revealed him. That's a challenge and remains a challenge, and many choose to ignore it. So we have some skeptics on the one hand saying we've looked at the history and we've found that Jesus was just a Jewish teacher whose followers after his death decided to invent a new religion in his name. And on the other hand, we have some theologians in reaction, not just against the skeptics, but against people like me, any attempt to reconstruct what actually happened, declaring grandly that since Jesus is the Lord of history, that's all we need to know. But in neither case are they really doing history at all. The real historical task, and with it the real theological prospect, is obscured or even ignored by both approaches. And this has left many ordinary Christians, including many hard-working clergy, bothered and unsure whether they can really trust the Gospels, whether they can really be sure about who Jesus was. I want to suggest there are good historical ways forward, though they may take us to some unexpected places. There is no secret to how good history is done. Historians debate this all the time in faculties and schools and so on. There are, of course, those debates, but history is real knowledge, not merely opinion or guesswork. It follows the accepted method of the natural sciences of investigation of data followed by hypothesis and verification. Of course, most natural sciences study things you can repeat, but history, like astronomy or geology, studies the unrepeatable. But the method is the same. But history particularly studies human motivation, which means thinking into the minds of people who think differently to ourselves. And history always aims at a connected narrative displaying cause and effect. not excluding the law of unintended consequences, which is one of the most important laws in history. Now, all this is basically about critical realism, what I and others have called critical realism. Critical realism is a fancy way of saying, we know that fake news exists, but that doesn't mean nothing happens. Let's get at what happens. And critical realism needs to employ what I and others have called the epistemology of love. When historians think into the minds of other people, it takes an act of sympathetic imagination. But that, like love itself, exists in the fragile space between lustful projection on the one hand, imagining the other to be the way I want them to be, and a detached indifference in which we don't try to get into the other mind at all. It's remarkable just how much scholarship about Jesus has not paid attention to these critical historical methods of working. And one of the most important things when you're getting into the mind of people who think differently from ourselves is to study the whole world that they lived in, the stories they told, the way they thought. And so much study right to the present day has put Jesus into a world called Judaism and has imagined Judaism simply as a dark backcloth of legalistic religion against which the supposed jewel of the gospel will shine the more brightly. There has to be a better way than that. So where do we begin? Space, time, and the forgotten hope. As historians, we know quite a bit about the larger world within which the story of Jesus takes place. Hopefully you know most of this already. The Romans took control of Judea and Galilee in the 60s BC. They ruled by various means, but finally lost patience, and after a devastating war, they destroyed Jerusalem and its temple in AD 70. And Jesus' public career took place right in the middle of that historical span, when resistance to Rome was smoldering rather than in open flame, but with rebellion never far from the surface. And Jesus was himself executed as a rebel king in the early 30s after a short public career. We know all this beyond any doubt. And we also know uncontroversially that the theme of Jesus' short public career was the announcement of God becoming king on earth as in heaven, an announcement which he made as much in deed as in word. And the theme of God's kingdom, which is clear in the Psalms and Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Daniel and elsewhere, was particularly current in the first century in revolutionary movements, wanting God alone to be king rather than the wicked rulers that they had. And Jesus explicitly hooked his own announcement into the ancient prophecies, the time is fulfilled, i.e. the time long predicted, not least by Daniel 9, and he radically reinterpreted its meaning through dramatic actions, healings and parties, and sharp-edged little stories, the parables. Now, this vivid picture of Jesus should not be open to historical doubt. The evidence converges at this point, and it makes excellent sense precisely in the complex world of the first third of the first century in the Middle East, rather than, say, in the 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s, by which time events and ideas had actually moved on significantly. But it's remarkable how the skeptics have failed really to tune in here and how the theologians have regularly left it out of consideration, only wanting to go back to the Gospels for such phrases and ideas as will be useful in much later dogmatic puzzles. No, we have to do the historical work of getting back into what's actually going on then. And there are three features of Jesus' public career to which we have to pay special attention. They are the temple, the Sabbath, and the future. Space, time, and history. The temple. What did the temple mean to a first century Jew? The temple was directly related to creation itself and to the promise of new creation. As either Dudley Moore or Peter Cook said about 40 years ago, not a lot of people know that. The opening chapters of Genesis portray the creation of heaven and earth as the construction of a temple. Creation, like a temple, is built in seven stages, and the final element is the image reflecting the divine presence into the world and channeling worship from creation back to the Creator. A temple, any temple in the ancient world, was designed as a place where heaven and earth would overlap and interlock. That is the point of the building. Our modern culture has embraced, as I hinted, a version of ancient Epicureanism in which, if the gods do exist, they're a long way away, so any idea of an overlap or an interlock is a category mistake. Hardly anyone in the ancient world thought like that. Genesis was written to say, among many other things, that God's good creation is a combined heaven and earth reality, and that the human vocation is to stand at the dramatic and dangerous point of intersection between the two, and that God himself has created this bipartite world for his own use, because he wants to come and dwell with his human creatures, to take his rest among them in his own true home. And this plays out in the overall shape of Genesis and Exodus. When the children of Israel were enslaved in Egypt, Moses said to Pharaoh that they had to be set free, quote, so that we can worship our God in the desert, unquote. Because the climax of Exodus is not the crossing of the Red Sea, nor even the giving of the law on Sinai. Those are just preparatory. The climax comes after the Israelites have nearly thrown it all away by making and worshiping the golden calf. The climax comes with the tabernacle, which represents creation itself, from the stars to the plants. And the glorious divine presence, what the later rabbis would call the Shekinah, the tabernacling presence, comes to dwell there in holy majesty. There is a narrative arc all the way from Genesis 1 to Exodus 40, which is picked up exactly by the prologue to John's Gospel. The creative word became flesh and tabernacled in our midst. That's what the Greek means. There's a vital twist here, which many ignore or forget altogether. The wilderness tabernacle, and then later the Jerusalem temple, were signposts pointing forward to a still greater reality. They were the signs and foretastes of what the Creator God, the God of Israel, longed to do with the whole of creation. The glorious filling of the wilderness tent pointed to the ultimate filling of all creation. Our residual Platonism means that we easily think of God's presence in a church or Christian assembly as a safe place, a safe spiritual place away from the world, a signpost to a disembodied reality called heaven, rather than a sign of what God ultimately intends for the whole world. Lots of biblical examples. I just take one, Psalm 72, which celebrates the coming true king who will do justice for the poor and the widow and the orphan and the outcast and the helpless. That's one of the king's three basic jobs. The other two, repel Israel's enemies and build or restore the temple. And these three are all aimed at the same thing, the coming of the divine glory to dwell with the people, to dwell in the world. The king repels the pagan enemies so that he will cleanse the land for God to come and live there. He builds the temple so that the divine presence may dwell there. And he does justice for the poor, Psalm 72, so that the divine glory may dwell in all the earth. That's how the psalm ends. Blessed be Yahweh forever, and may his glory fill the whole earth. Amen and amen. The whole world is claimed as God's holy land. The temple-shaped promise is the promise that the heaven plus earth reality there will be translated into the heaven plus earth reality of the whole renewed creation. And as in Genesis 1, the heaven and earth reality is focused on the human being through whom it all happens. The king is the true image bearer, the genuine human. Some Jews were already reading Genesis 1 and Psalm 8, which reflects it, as meaning exactly that. Jesus seems to have picked up on those traditions and made them his own. My friends, once you see all this, you will never read the Gospels the same way again. So what happens when we put Jesus and his public career into this world, a world of promised glory for temple and creation? Jesus appears as a prophet announcing God's kingdom. He accepts that designation as a start, but it soon appears that he believes himself to be more than a prophet. He is the true king, even though he's redefining kingship around himself in a creative new synthesis of Israel's scriptures. He isn't doing what would-be messiahs might expect to be doing, particularly planning armed revolution, but he is doing things that Isaiah and the Psalms prophesied: healing the sick, welcoming the outcast, and so on. And when he openly and publicly forgives sins, he is claiming to do and be what the temple was and did. Jesus is slicing through the protocol and offering right there on the street what you'd normally get by going to the temple. And his regular and notorious feasting with sinners and outcasts looks like a dramatic demonstration pointing towards that Psalm 72 agenda, reinforced again and again by parables like the prodigal son. So Jesus' public career offers throughout an implicit challenge to the temple, which has massive implications, granted the temple theology I just mentioned. So when he comes to Jerusalem for the final Passover, and it's vital to remember that Jesus chose Passover as the moment to do what had to be done, his challenge becomes explicit. What he did in the temple wasn't a clean-up operation. Jesus wasn't demanding some sort of reform. He was denouncing the present temple and its leadership, and also the way in which the revolutionary movements were seeing the temple as a sign that their projected violence would bring in God's kingdom. No, he says, you have made it a den of brigands. Lestai is the Greek word, which means brigands or revolutionaries. And when he stops the flow of sacrificial animals by driving out the traders and the animals, he is performing a symbolic demonstration of the temple's upcoming destruction. And everything in the gospel passages that follow that action explain that from one angle or another. And at the same time, he is offering something radically different, something symbolized by his own quasi-Passover meal with his friends. I've said it many times, when Jesus wanted to explain to his followers what his forthcoming death was going to be all about, he didn't give them a theory, he gave them a meal. All sorts of things follow from that. Something was happening, as a result of which the temple itself was redundant in the face of the promised reality, and it was under judgment as in the days of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And when we put all this in the context of what I've suggested was the deep but understood meaning of the temple in that culture, the implication is massive. Jesus believed that in his words and deeds, the glorious and devastating presence of Israel's God was manifest at last. He was the place where, and the means by which, heaven and earth would come together at last. That's picked up exactly by Paul in Ephesians chapter 1. He was, in other words, the true image. He was the true king. And he believed that with his forthcoming death and its aftermath, the kingdom would indeed be established in a whole new way on earth as in heaven. Now, what I've just said about the temple applies just as much to the Sabbath. The Sabbath was to time what the temple was to place. The temple was where heaven and earth met, held together in a dangerous symbiosis, with the image-bearing humans standing at the fault line in worship and obedience. The Sabbath was where the age to come broke into the present age so that God's future and God's present were held together again with human beings standing at the threshold in a single moment of rest and celebration, with the past coming forwards as well, the creation, the original Exodus, all the other moments of divine triumph in Israel's history. You see, the Sabbath stories in the Gospels have been treated as examples of Jewish legalism versus Christian freedom. That's not the point. Jesus' opening announcement was the time is fulfilled. His Nazareth manifesto in Luke 4 was about the Jubilee, the great 7x7, the year of release. To the Jew, the Sabbath was the moment when every week that age to come would arrive in advance, mysteriously. Even in the ongoing world of sin and death, you might live for a full 24 hours in the promised new age. So the Sabbaths, like the temple, were a sign and a foretaste. The temple was the signpost to God's intention to fill the whole world with his presence. The Sabbaths were advanced glimpses of the age to come, with the future somehow nesting dangerously in the present. The Sabbath candles were the sign that one day God's new day would dawn, and Jesus was declaring that the sun was rising and you don't need candles anymore. The Sabbath controversies, therefore, were about the already of the kingdom. If I, by the finger of God, cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. And Jesus' parables fit exactly here. They were affirming the Jewish expectation of God's kingdom on earth as in heaven. They weren't, as many Western Christians have imagined, saying, no, not on earth. It's all about leaving earth and going to heaven. No, they were affirming that expectation. They were announcing that it was now fulfilled, but they were redefining it away from the revolutionary aspirations of Jesus' day and towards Jesus' own more radical understanding of the scriptures and of his own vocation. So where was it going to end? Temple plus Sabbath equals eschatology. What did Jesus say about the future? We've had a complete caricature sold to us for the last 100 and more years. We were all taught in seminary, college, whatever, that Jesus and his first followers expected the actual end of the world at any moment. How did that mistake arise? A mistake which many clergy, having been taught, still wrestle with, and many laity too. In the 19th century, many European scholars had been convinced that the progressive advances of Western culture constituted the steady arrival of the kingdom of God. It's associated with the German theologian Ritschl. But the mask had begun to slip. Kierkegaard in Denmark had denounced the Hegelian idea of progressive development. Nietzsche was saying that the whole thing was a fraud. Karl Marx had transformed Hegel's secularized progress into revolution, which is a secularized version of Jewish apocalyptic. And two young scholars, Johannes Weiss and Albert Schweitzer, at the end of the 19th century, they caught that mood of the times, and they declared that first century Jews, and Jesus in particular, when they spoke of the kingdom of God, meant the imminent end of the world. And that's become received scholarly orthodoxy in many circles. But they got it wrong. Haven't got time for the full case today, but let me just say this. They had not studied Jewish apocalyptic in its historical and political context. Schweitzer, one of my heroes, but like all my heroes and like I myself has feet of clay, of course, Schweitzer was a brilliant philosopher and musician, an expert on Johannes Sebastian Bach, but also a massive fan of Richard Wagner. Did you know that? Particularly of the Ring cycle. Schweitzer attended performances of the Ring in Bayreuth 4 times during the very years when he was writing about Jesus and the kingdom of God. Now, the Ring, as you may know, offers a Nietzschean view of the world, the truth that everything ends. Schweitzer transposed that into first century history. And many saw his work as a word for the times, a word of devastating warning over against the casual 19th century optimism, which was indeed about to crash and burn in the trenches of the First World War, which kind of solidified Schweitzer's view in many people's minds. And to this day, confusion continues. But the answer to confusion is historical exegesis, proper, careful exegesis. What did apocalyptic language mean in the first century? When first century Jews echoed books like Daniel or 1 Enoch, what were they talking about? The post-Enlightenment philosophical climate, characterized by that split world of Epicureanism, the gods are a long way away and they don't do anything with us, was bound to give the wrong answer, because if you start by assuming that heaven is entirely different to earth, then if heaven comes to reign, earth will have to be abolished to make room for it. But that is neither biblical nor Jewish. Likewise, the idea of leaving earth to go to heaven is a Platonic response to that, not an early Christian one. Jesus taught us to pray, "Thy kingdom come on earth as in heaven," an idea which Epicureanism finds impossible and Platonism finds undesirable. Instead of both, the first century retrieval of Jewish apocalyptic was what we would call political, but the political was here fully mixed with the theological. God is creator and Lord of all. When Isaiah described the sun and the moon being darkened and the stars falling from heaven, my colleague John Barton in Oxford, a good friend from way back when, used to say in lectures, if you read a text saying the sun will be darkened, the moon turned into blood, and the stars will be fallen, you know as a matter of genre that the next line is not going to be that the rest of the country will have scattered showers and sunny intervals. He was talking about the fall of Babylon. And when Jeremiah warned that the created order would go back to being without form and void, he worried for years that he might be a false prophet, not because the world was still going on, but because the temple had not yet fallen. The temple was the heaven and earth place. If the temple fell, chaos come again. We know from first century sources how those traditions were being read in the first century. The language of apocalyptic dreams and visions with God's kingdom overthrowing and replacing the kingdoms of the world was not about the end of the world in the modern sense. That's a trivial misreading. And that theory has enabled many to label the first Christians as simple pre-scientific folk with all sorts of funny ideas which we now know aren't true, which neatly absolves us from following their theology or ethics if we don't like them either. That line is merely self-serving, part of the gangrene of liberal reductionism. But when we put all this together, what do we find about Jesus' announcement of the kingdom? We find that he was indeed talking about an end and a beginning, but it was the end not of the space-time universe, but of the long years in which Israel's temple and the Sabbaths had been the focal point of heaven and earth, the forward-looking signposts. The sun was rising and the candles were no longer needed. Jesus was declaring that the age to come had arrived once and for all in the present, not as a weekly advanced celebration, but as a new permanent reality. But it was to run concurrently with the ongoing present age until a yet future date. So that Jesus' followers, as Paul says again and again, would find themselves suffering from theological jet lag, living simultaneously in two different theological time zones. With Jesus, there are two further things to say before we bring all this together or try to. For Jesus, the ultimate victory over the powers of darkness, which would establish the kingdom of God in the world, was yet to happen. That was to happen through what he was to do on the cross. That was at the heart of Jesus' understanding of his own death. I've explored that in my book, The Day the Revolution Began, where I argue that for Jesus and Paul and the gospel writers, the cross is to be seen as the victory over the dark powers that have enslaved the world. It's the new Passover. And this victory is achieved through what we call representative substitution. You must not play these ideas off against one another. But as far as the Gospels and Paul are concerned, looking back, the victory has already been won. Yes, Caesar is still ruling the world. The temple was still standing, but both were tottering, and a new reality had been launched upon the world, a perpetual Sabbath, a new kind of temple. They believed all this because they believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead, demonstrating his victory over evil by his victory over evil's consequence, namely death. And they believed that the Spirit was at work in and through them, bringing reconciliation, new community, a new way of being human, which they were amazedly and delightedly experimenting. All this, of course, is a vast topic for another time. But then the other wrinkle, and more than a wrinkle, is that at the heart of the Jewish vision of the future was the hope, closely bound up with the temple, that Yahweh himself would return in person to rescue his people and set up his kingdom. Isaiah says that explicitly in chapter 40, chapter 52, favorite passages in the New Testament. So do Ezekiel, so does Zechariah, so does Malachi 3. Again, a favorite quote, the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. All four Gospels and Paul draw on such texts and insist that with Jesus it's come true. Historical critics and theologians alike have ignored this, but I believe it's at the very heart of New Testament Christology. That when we look at Jesus' public career, climaxing in his death and resurrection and ascension, we are meant to think, this is what it looked like when Israel's God did what he'd said and returned suddenly to his temple in glory. Can history prove the truth of such a claim? It's the crucial question. No, but history can, because anyone can say, oh, well, maybe Jesus did think like that, too bad. But history can reshape the question of what was Jesus actually doing and thinking in such a way as to challenge our truncated view of knowledge and proof themselves and offer a better one. So today I want to bring this lecture back where it began by asking what we learn from all this about the question of Jesus and God. A revived natural theology, not that all the natural theologians will like it. I've suggested that historical study of the first century poses a direct challenge to the modern assumed Epicurean framework. In particular, it challenges what has essentially been a Faustian pact, you know the Faust legend, in which the real heart of knowledge, namely love itself, has been pushed aside. You know, Faust is offered anything he wants, power, money, success, fame, etc., etc., as long as he does not love. That's one of the clues to modern culture. The real heart of knowledge, namely love itself, has been pushed aside so that a ruthlessly driven progress could proceed unchecked. Well, we've seen where that got us. That project has produced, as well as all the horrors of the 20th century, fortress Europe and America first, an attempted Epicurean paradise removed from the rest of the world, a secular temple, a secular age to come, a parody of the gospel. Which is why, to suit that modern world, Christianity is seen as a religion, which is about the upstairs reality. If you want to escape to that world, you're welcome. That is the political analog of the failure of natural theology. And even if we don't want to engage the question for philosophical reasons, the urgent political crises of our day ought to tell us that this isn't just about spirituality or religion. It's about which God or gods are ruling the world, which God or gods we are going to serve. Three pinpricks of ideas about how to approach this question as I finish. They focus on the central gospel themes, the cross, the resurrection, and the mission of God. Each could, of course, be expanded indefinitely. First, the paradox of the cross meets the paradox of human longing. The paradox of the cross meets the paradox of human longing. There are seven vital strands of human life, things for which we all long: justice, freedom, beauty, spirituality, truth, power, and love. I'll read that list again. Justice, freedom, beauty, spirituality, truth, power, and love. In each case, we all know that they're crucially important, but we all find them elusive, harder to attain and to hold on to than we want. We feel them to be clues to the meaning of life, but they appear to let us down. Justice is denied or distorted. Freedom is twisted into license or new forms of slavery. The beautiful sunset disappears. Spirituality becomes self-serving fantasy. Truth becomes fake news. Power corrupts, and love changes into either lust or grief. This is why many see natural theology as pointless. All the things that might seem to be signals of transcendence, whatever people mean by that, turn to dust and ashes as we reach out to grasp them. But here's my point. The gospel story of Jesus going to his death meets this dark human narrative at its low point. The story of Jesus does not enable us to stretch up grandly and find God. It declares that God has come down to meet us in our dust and ashes. And that, I believe, as Jesus goes to his death with a failure of justice, with the catastrophic denial of beauty of spirituality, with freedom squashed, with Pilate saying what is truth, with the abuse of power, and with love itself thrown in the dirt. That's part of the secret of the power. The reason why the cross, in pictures or statues or art or music, perhaps especially in music, I think, has the power to leap over human skepticism and incomprehension and to open up recesses of the human imagination and understanding which we didn't know were there. And it is precisely at the point where Jesus appears to have failed in what his followers thought was his bid to establish an ordinary kingdom. Precisely at that point, we have a sense of ultimate connection. The cross, as we say, finds us where we are. It's that wonderful story about the former Roman Catholic Archbishop of Paris who told the tale of three naughty little boys going into a provincial church to confess sins. They went into the confessional and imagined all sorts of sins and confessed to the priest, etc., etc. Priest realized what was going on. And the third boy, after the first two had run away, he said, "Okay, I'm giving you a penance. I want you to go up to the front of the church and look at that huge statue of Jesus on the cross and say, 'You did all that for me, and I don't give a damn.' And I want you to do that three times." The boy went off, "Fine, okay, this is a bit more fun. You did all that for me and I don't give a damn." Then he did it the second time. And then he couldn't do it the third time. And he broke down and left the church changed. And the archbishop, who was Archbishop of Paris the last 25 years of last century, said, "The reason I know that story is that I was that young man." Something about the cross which meets us where we are. Is that natural theology? I wonder. But in particular, second, all this has therefore the capacity to awaken a genuine love. And to repeat, love here is not fantasy or sentiment. We need many more words. It is the delighted recognition of a truth beyond ourselves. It is reaching out in response to a reality which is not from ourselves, but somehow for ourselves. The Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. Yes, but that can only be said in the light of the resurrection. That's why Ludwig Wittgenstein said, startlingly, it is love that believes the resurrection. Because the actual events of the gospel, focusing on Jesus' death and resurrection, evoke that love as a new dimension. I've spoken about the ordinary epistemology of love, which is required in any case for good investigation, for all knowledge, especially for history. But this new dimension opens up because in the resurrection it becomes clear that the Creator of the world has declared his love for his creation, including for ourselves, not just in theory but in practice. The news that Jesus has been raised and is now alive in a whole new way, bodily but with a transformed, immortal physicality, that tells us that our world, the creation which we know, that our deepest longings, which are framed and frustrated in equal measure by our present created but corruptible existence, are redemptively affirmed. The resurrection is God's yes to creation. They are not, they cannot be affirmed as they stand because of their inherent corruption. But the act of redemption is not to snatch us away from the world, but to reaffirm the goodness of the world. And with that, the revelation of the Creator's love. The love which believes the resurrection is therefore an answering love, which is the ultimate form of knowledge. As Paul says, based not on our knowledge of God, but on God's knowledge of us. And this kind of knowledge, the knowledge that refuses the Faustian pact of modernity and which allows love to set its terms, includes but also transcends the many good historical arguments in which Jesus' resurrection is the only answer to the question of how Christianity got off the ground in the first place. History is important, but as I know from years of doing it, by itself, the best historical arguments may never themselves convince the skeptic. Likewise, history includes but transcends the emotional appeal, which is all many can hear in the word love, but which would collapse into private experience rather than public truth. You know, the old song, "You ask me how I know he lives within my heart." That may be true, but it lacks the power to convince others. They may say, "Well, that's true for you. Good luck to you. It's not true for me." No. The message of Jesus' resurrection, though, is the message that new creation is launched because the powers of darkness have been defeated on the cross. And the message of new creation is thus the message of a deeper love, a deeper sense of welcome home than humans could otherwise imagine. And that's when we see, in the response in John's Gospel of Mary and Thomas and Peter to the resurrection, the ultimate mystery opens before us. "My Lord," says Thomas, "and my God." All this only really appears when the hard historical work has been done, so we can see what the four Gospels really are telling us over and above truncated modern misunderstandings. Of course, none of this proves anything in terms of a shrunken mathematical proof, but the shrill demand for such things is itself a trick of that Faustian reductionism to which our culture has been subjected. But once we recognize that the claim of Jesus himself and his first followers had nothing to do with the end of the space-time world and everything to do with the great Sabbath, the transformative arrival of the age to come within the present age, and with it the dangerous joining of heaven and earth in Jesus himself and by his Spirit, then, the believing love which answers the Creator's love in raising Jesus can be seen for what it is, not the adoption of a cold dogma, but the embrace of and commitment to the project of God's kingdom on earth as in heaven. And that leads briefly, very briefly, to my final point. Following from this vision of the cross and the resurrection and Christology, we have the Spirit-induced mission of the church. That is part of the apologetic task. Just as the temple was an advance, effective sign of God's intention to flood the whole creation with his presence, just as the Sabbaths were advance signposts of the age to come, so the Spirit-led mission of the church is the effective advance sign of that coming age, in which creation will be transformed and the divine justice and beauty and love will fill all things so that God may be all in all. And this means that the church's mission, what you are all engaged in, thank God, including the announcement that God raised Jesus from the dead and that through his death the power of evil has been defeated so that forgiveness of sins is now offered to all, this mission must be framed in terms of new creation. Because if justice, freedom, beauty, spirituality, truth, power, and love are reaffirmed as the genuine God-given longings which seemed to have failed in the cross, then their reaffirmation in the resurrection means that by the Spirit, the church must be working at all seven simultaneously, not resting content with a Platonic promise of a disembodied heaven or the Gnostic delusion of self-fulfillment. The mission of God thus belongs quite properly, I believe, as part of natural theology, since it addresses the puzzled awareness of all humans living in the world of nature itself. I don't believe, then, that you can start with what you find in a test tube and argue up to God without anything else. But if the test tube reminds you to look at the larger world, including the world of history, including the fact of Jesus himself, then, when you look with answering love, you will glimpse in the face of Jesus, as Paul said, the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. Thank you very much.